Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 11-765, State versus Lockman, arguing for the petitioner, Brandon Ito, arguing for the respondent, Harrison Kim, argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. Justice Pollack had a statement he wished to make for the record.
Yeah, I'd like to disclose that one of my law clerks has accepted a job with the Honolulu Prosecutor's Office as of yesterday, and he will do no more work on this case, nor has he done any work on this case after the interview was scheduled. Any objection to the court continuing?
Okay, very well. Thank you. And then my understanding is, Mr. Ito, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a light that will come on and let you know when we get to that point in your argument. Mr. Kim will warn you when there's 5 minutes to go in your argument as well. Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Ito.
Thank you. May it please the court, Brandon Ito, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the State of Hawaii. Fairness in this case should not depend solely on satisfying the interests of the one, but instead on balancing the interests of the many. We are all stakeholders, in a way, of our in our criminal justice system, the prosecutors and the state, the defendant and his counsel, even this judiciary, which includes our trial judges and their staff. We are all stakeholders. We all have an interest in the fair and orderly administration of justice. This case raises significant issues. Dispositive among them is whether this defendant waived his disjunctive charge assertion under Rule 12 of our Rules of Penal Procedure. In the state's view, Rule 12 represents a balance of the many interests involved by providing some degree of order and fairness in the procedures we follow in our criminal cases. In other words, Rule 12 represents a reasonable time limitation on when certain objections and defenses must be made in order to accommodate other legitimate interests in the criminal trial process. For example, the state has an interest in being provided with a sufficient amount of time to respond to any objection or defense that a defendant raises. The state also has an interest in its preparation and planning for trial inasmuch as a timely motion to dismiss would have obviated the need for its witnesses to be present at trial. Or, hypothetically, a state witness could have been flown in from out of state to testify at the trial at the expense of the state. This judiciary also has an interest in the efficient use of its limited resources. For example, depending on the success of the pretrial motion, another case could have been scheduled for trial on May 27, 2011, rather than this case. Moreover, it's the state's understanding that a juror is entitled to receive compensation for his or her service. Hypothetically, if this were a jury trial and the disjunctive charge motion was made in the middle or at the end of the jury trial, and the trial court dismissed the state's charge on defendant's motion, the financial costs expended on this jury, hypothetical jury, would have been wasted.
Well, there wouldn't have been a jury trial on a harassment charge.
Well, yes, I'm speaking strictly hypothetically.
Wouldn't you have a recourse if something like that came up in the middle of a case, if there was some error? Don't you have something you can do?
I don't understand.
Well, could not the prosecutor, once that motion was made, couldn't the prosecutor have said, well, Judge, yes, there's an error. I'm moving to amend the complaint.
Well, I think under rule, I'm not sure what rule it is, but amendment to a charge cannot be made if it affects the, if it's prejudicial to the defendant. And I think
how would that be prejudicial? I mean, the defense is arguing they're prejudiced by the fact that they don't know whether it's either or. If you amend it and say, and or, then the defendant would be advantaged under their theory.
Well, the state's position is that the state shouldn't have to move to amend the charge. If the motion to dismiss was timely brought, then yes, perhaps a motion to amend could be explored at that point. But in this case, the motion to dismiss was made right after the defendant was arraigned, right when trial began. So again, one of the state's interests in a timely pretrial motion to dismiss is that it has sufficient amount of time to respond to his motion. So again, we are all stakeholders in our criminal justice system. We all have an interest in the fair and orderly administration of justice.
Was it ever much of a surprise? I mean, was the prosecution surprised?
From this transcript, it seems so.
Well, he just claimed 72 hours, but as a matter of fact, the ICA had already come out with McCarthy, well, how many months ago? 7 months before this trial?
Well, with all due respect, Justice Acoba, I don't think Rule 12 depends on whether or not the prosecutor was surprised. It's whether the defense counsel made his motion in a timely manner. And in this case, the pretrial motion's deadline that was extended by the circuit court or by the family court, the pretrial motion's deadline passed by the time the defendant made his motion to dismiss.
Yeah, well, you know, there's qualifying language in the rule itself, in Rule 12, I guess, F. But was there any problem with, as Justice Pollack indicated, that you could just have amended that at that point? Because we assume that you know the law, the defense attorney knows the law, and the judge knows the law. And the ICA come down 7 months before McCarthy, and I assume everyone read that, and it affected, I mean, you were here in Kodiamont, you know, everyone knew that the ICA had said you have to use and, but not or.
Well, I can't speak for this particular trial prosecutor, or whether he knew, or whether he, even if he was surprised by the motion, but again,
is it a substantial right to know what you're accused of?
Is it a substantial? Yes, it is.
Okay. So here, if we assume, and I guess there may be disagreement as to whether or not or is sufficient notice of what a defendant is charged with in terms of conduct, but if or does not sufficiently apprise the defendant of what conduct he or she is accused of, wouldn't that be a substantial, an infringement of a substantial right?
Well, I'm taking a guess here, and you're referring to plain error.
Okay.
I do not believe that the plain error rule should be read in conjunction with Rule 12, because to do so would essentially render the Rule 12 waiver rule meaningless. If the Rule 12 waiver rule is going to have any teeth, it has to have, whether an alleged defect in the charge affects a defendant's substantial rights or not, that defendant should be expected to make that motion in a timely manner, before the pretrial motion's deadline. If he does not, then under Rule 12, it is waived, unless he can show a cause to be granted relief for the waiver. And no, I do not believe that plain error also is a sufficient basis to show cause, because if that were the case, then again, the waiver rule would also be rendered meaningless, because conceivably, any argument that a defendant makes, almost any argument, well, I haven't thought of any argument that where a defendant alleges a certain defect in the charge and that alleged defect does not affect one or more of his constitutional rights, such as due process or being informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him. In my mind, the alleging that one's constitutional rights in one way or another has been adversely affected by some alleged error in the charge is a relatively easy matter for a defense counsel to do. And if this court is going to condition whether or not a Rule 12 waiver analysis should consider such a consideration, again, Rule 12 would be rendered meaningless.
Did the defense attorney ask the court to waive the Rule 12 requirement?
Not to my knowledge.
Does the court's ruling reflect whether that was the basis that it was untimely, or did the judge reach the merits?
Well, the record of this case reflects that the trial deputy made it abundantly clear to the trial court that his objection to the motion was, first, it was untimely. And yes, the record of this case reflects that the response that the trial court gave was simply motion denied. He hasn't explained the basis of it.
So the judge could have reached the merits.
In State v. Markowski, which is a case that the state relied on in its answering brief, the ICA repeatedly relied on a case called United States v. Oldfield. And in that case, the Oldfield court said, quote, if a party fails the time they file a Rule 12b motion, the merits of the motion are not preserved for appeal, even if the district court chose to hear the motion. The district court's review of the motion does not alter the fact that the motion to suppress was made in violation of Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 12b3, nor does it alter the fact that the defendant waived the objection under Criminal Rule 12f. The Markowski court also relied on Moore's Federal Practice, 3rd edition. In Moore's Federal Practice, 3rd edition, section 612.06 at page 612-28 to 29, this treatise said, the question of waiver may arise for the first time on appeal or during post-conviction proceedings, as well as at trial. So regardless if the trial court's, the record of this case reflects that the trial court actually considered the merits of the motion or concluded that the pretrial, what's supposed to be a pretrial motion, was waived, this issue is now squarely before this court and the arguments that have been advanced, at least on appeal, as well as preserved at trial. To the extent that this court or majority thereof doesn't believe that we should address this waiver issue, the state respectfully submits that this court at least address in dicta what's supposed to be a pretrial motion was waived, because this isn't the first case where this has happened, and I doubt it's going to be the last, unless this court says something.
Mr. Ito, are you familiar with cases in the past from this court that have said that where a charging document doesn't sufficiently apprise the defendant of what conduct he is charged with committing amounts to a failure to state an offense?
I'm sorry, can you repeat?
Are you aware of prior case law issued by this court which says that the failure of a charging document to apprise a defendant of conduct for which he is accused amounts to a failure to charge an offense?
I am aware of the block quote in State versus Spratling.
State versus?
Spratling. Got it.
Okay. What about State versus Israel?
No, I'm not aware.
What about State versus Cummings?
No, I'm not aware.
So if there are at least three cases this court has issued which says that the failure to apprise a defendant of what conduct he is accused of amounts to a failure to state an offense, do you think that that is precedent that would control this case?
I respectfully disagree.
What, you disagree that that's precedent?
I disagree in the application of the precedent to this case, if it were to apply to this case, because what I block quoted in my application for certiorari was, quote, the sufficiency of the charging instrument is measured inter alia by whether it contains the elements of the offense intended to be charged and sufficiently apprises the defendant of what he or she must be prepared to meet. That's the first sentence. Second sentence, a charge defective in this regard amounts to a failure to state an offense, and a conviction based upon it cannot be sustained. That would constitute a denial of due process, close quote. These two sentences, if one traces the line of authorities from where these two sentences originate, one will quickly realize that these two sentences that I just quoted constitute a juxtaposition or a compilation of two propositions of law from two different cases, none of which address the disjunctive charging issue before this court today.
The assumption is that or doesn't apprise a person. But assuming that the failure to apprise a person of conduct that he's accused of amounts to a failure to state an offense, would that be an exception to the timing requirement under Rule 12?
Well, assuming, hypothetically, totally arguendo, that were how this court would construe the compilation of those two sentences, then yes. But I don't construe it that way, because the first sentence that I quoted comes from Speak versus Wells. And in Wells, the issue was whether or not an essential element was omitted. The second sentence came straight from State versus Gendrush, in which this court repeatedly said that an omission of an essential element constitutes a fatal defect and thus, or constitutes a fatal defect and a failure to state an offense. And charging an outdated version of the offense certainly is a failure to state an offense. The Gendrush court specifically noted that in its opinion, yet in footnote 4, it didn't say that. So based on Gendrush alone, the state submits that this argument here, or the disjunctive issue here, does not neither constitutes a fatal defect nor a failure to state an offense.
But was it contended by the defendant here at any point that there was a failure to state an essential element?
No, there was not. Instead, his argument is that the charge did not provide him with sufficient notice of the nature and cause of the accusation against him.
So that's a due process argument as opposed to a failure to charge an offense?
Yes, that is correct. So again, to this end, or as I mentioned before, fairness in this case should not depend solely on satisfying the interest of the one, which in this case would be the defendant. Instead, fairness in this case should depend on balancing the interests of the many. To this end, rather than condition a failure to state an offense on a general assertion that the charge allegedly did not sufficiently apprise the defendant of what he must be prepared to meet, as the ICA majority did in this case, what constitutes a failure to state an offense should depend on the specific allegation of error, whether it's an omission of essential element, charging an outdated version of an offense, using the word or instead of the word and, or a duplicitous charge.
You know, go ahead.
Under Gendrus, the first two charging errors that I just mentioned constitute a failure to state an offense, as I mentioned before.
Could you please speak up? I'm sorry.
Under Gendrush, the first two charging errors that I just mentioned, omitting an essential element of an offense and charging an outdated version of an offense, constitutes a failure to state an offense under Gendrush. Unlike these two charging errors, Gendrush never held that the use of the word or alone constitutes a failure to state an offense. And because it didn't say so, yet said expressly that the omission of an essential element and charging an outdated version of an offense constitutes a failure to state an offense. The logical conclusion is that the Gendrush court never held that the use of the word or in the charge constitutes a fatal defect, nor a failure to state an offense. If there are no further questions, say something further.
Anything further? Okay, thank you, Mr. Ito. We'll now hear from Mr. Kim.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good morning.
Members of the court. We're asking this honorable court to affirm the Intermediate Court of Appeals summary disposition order filed February 26, 2013. And the first issue regarding the untimeliness of the motion, we believe, is not an issue because the court did entertain the motion. The motion was denied, and as mentioned earlier, the prosecutor did bring it up. The record, as Justice Pollack made an inquiry, the record indicates that the judge, the prosecutor did bring up the untimeliness issue. The defense attorney at that time, who was deputy public defender on the case, mentioned this issue, that there wasn't reasonable notice based on the fact of the conjunctive or the disjunctive pleading. And then the judge just said motion denied. So we would assert that indeed the pretrial motion deadline was May 19, 2011 in this case. The motion to dismiss was made at the start of trial on May 27, 2011, but by having entertained counsel's arguments, then denying the motion, we submit that the court granted a waiver, or even extended the motion's deadline, if you will, pursuant to Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure 12F.
Was there any argument by defense counsel at that point that would establish good cause for granting a waiver?
I believe that the good cause is ingrained in the idea that the defense counsel at that time mentioned that the disjunctive pleading doesn't afford him notice, if you will. But that's all that was argued, if you will.
But that wouldn't explain why the motion wasn't filed earlier.
I understand. Yes, Your Honor. That doesn't explain why the motion wasn't filed earlier. That's correct. Yeah. And but nevertheless, if this court believes that that is not the case, that 12F does not apply here, certainly the ICA was correct in that the charge failed to state an offense. Accordingly, the motion to dismiss was timely, as it could have been brought at any time during the proceedings, pursuant to Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure 12B2. And basically, the state asserts, simply put, the pleading by harassment in the disjunctive failed to sufficiently apprise Mr. Lockie of what he must be prepared to meet. And the state asserts that with the exception of this case, the state is unaware of any case that has held the use of the word or instead of the word and, or the words and or alone constitutes a failure to state an offense. Nevertheless,
Mr. Kim, you know, the prosecutor said right then and there, this is a simple case. He threw a bottle of water at her face. Is that enough notice?
No, that is not enough notice, Your Honor.
But why isn't that?
Because the complaint has to be sufficient on its face. And because we're talking about constitutional rights and the right to for the accused to know what he's being accused of, obviously. Okay, so it's not sufficient notice in that sense. Gendrich makes it clear that charging in the disjunctive rather than the conjunctive leaves defendants uncertain as to which acts. Well, I know the court is well aware of what Gendrich says, and it was relied upon on the basis of accusation.
Not only Gendrich, subsequent to that case, were there other cases that said that?
Yes, I would submit that the other cases that pretty much indicate this fall on the idea that when you're not afforded proper notice.
But even the ICA admits, I assume they try to follow our precedent, admits that or means under our precedent that the defendant is not apprised of what conduct he or she is being accused of.
Yes.
I mean, that was the whole basis for, I guess, Judge Nakamura's dissent. He said, I have to follow precedent, and the precedent here is that the disjunctive doesn't apprise the person, but he didn't file in time. He didn't raise his objection in time.
That's correct. That's what he says in this case. Okay. Right. And we would submit that if the charge...
How do we get to the point where, you know, we have all these cases that say, or means... the disjunctive doesn't notify the defendant of what conduct is the crux of the case. How do we get to this point where we have these cases that say that? Seems to be established precedent, but it's not followed. How do we get to that point?
That I don't understand that issue myself, Your Honor, in the sense that... in the sense that the prosecutor does charge in other cases by the conjunctive disjunctive method. In fact, and I don't understand why they don't do it across the board in that sense. In fact, last night I pulled out some operating a vehicle under influence complaints that I have sitting in my office where they do charge in the conjunctive disjunctive. And I was thinking about how do, you know, if we get to practical terms, if we may, how do I, as a defense attorney, adequately inform my client of what the complaint says when it's or versus and or, if you will. Now, for example, in the operating a vehicle under the influence of intoxicant, now the complaints have been saying that you did operate or assume actual physical control of a vehicle upon a public way, street, road, or highway, and then they go on and on, and then and or did operate or assume actual physical control of a vehicle upon a public way, street, road, or highway with 0.08 grams of alcohol per 10 liters of breath, okay? So, as a practical matter, when a client comes in and sits with me and I discuss with them what does the prosecutor have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt based on this charge in front of us, I will tell my client, and I do tell my client, that they gotta choose, I mean, they gotta prove either or of them or both of them, okay? And that helps me tell my client that, okay, they're gonna bring an intoxilizer operator, so we gotta prepare for that, I gotta prepare for that. They're gonna bring in the PC officer, the reasonable suspicion officer who made the initial stop. I tell my client what they gotta prove beyond a reasonable doubt, okay? If it's made in the conjunctive, if this was written in the conjunctive, there's a great sense of uncertainty on how I can actually advise my client. I don't understand, how do I tell my client, oh, they may bring in the intoxilizer officer, or they may bring in the probable cause officer, or the FST officer. I don't know which way they're gonna go here, okay? But if it's with the conjunctive, when it's pled in the conjunctive, I am able to tell my client exactly what we can expect when we go to trial. Now it happens, and this has happened many times as well, where I've gone to court, and then at the very last minute, the prosecutor says, oh, we don't have our intoxilizer operator here, we don't have my intoxilizer supervisor here, but I think we have enough to go on the A1, the operator, assume actual physical control vehicle on a public way street.
Well, counsel, your position is if it's in the conjunctive and, then the prosecution has to prove both prongs?
Well, they,
is that
they,
what you're saying?
No, it's subsumed and subsumes or. So they can prove either one of them. But as far as notice to me and my client, that way I'm prepared with my client to go with both of them. And I can tell adequately advise my client as to what to expect.
And how is it that the use of the word or for us would makes that harder?
It makes it harder in the sense that when I advise my client, we're uncertain. We don't know which way this thing is going to go. We don't know what the prosecutor, who the prosecutor is going to bring into the courtroom. We don't know.
But that would be true if it was and. I mean, under either scenario, the prosecutor can prove in the disjunctive, right? Isn't that right? The prosecutor.
That's true. So but as far as
No.
But as far as notice, Your Honor, as far as notice and what we are prepared to meet if we go to court, I believe and or, however you put it, any sort of conjunctive pleading promotes a sense of certainty that helps with my client's rights to understand what's going on. It actually helps the attorney, if you will. It helps me advise my client. So we submit that when you look at, and again, what I was going to say too was that when you go to court, and this happened many times in the DUI type cases, if I may use the word DUI instead of OVUII, what has happened many times when it went to court is the prosecutor has mentioned at the last minute and said, you know, we're not going to go with the A3, okay? We're not going to, because we don't have our intoxilizer operator here, but I think we have enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the A1, okay? Well, then that's fine, okay? Because I, along with my client, was prepared and we were certain to defend against both, okay? Whereas if it was or, we would have walked into the courtroom not understanding which one they were going to prove or try and prove. So it's a notice issue. We believe that it is a notice issue, and I believe it's a failure to state an offense in that regard based on court precedent.
But doesn't or mean or? So if it says or, you would reasonably be alerted that it's going to be one or the other. It's not immediately apparent how and or promotes understanding of that kind. But arguably, and would promote misunderstanding because it would indicate to the client that they have to prove both when in fact the prosecutor only has to prove one.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I think the other thing that it, the other problem with that
but
is
we don't really care whether, well, we care in a sense that the lawyers understand, but when we have to construe a criminal statute in terms of whether it's vague or gives sufficient notice, we have to look at it from the point of view of a person, a layperson, a person of ordinary intelligence. And so in determining what or would signify, we're primarily concerned with what or would signify to a person to use a term of ordinary intelligence, or to a lay person, right?
That's correct.
Because they're the ones whose property or freedom is at stake. And they should be able to understand it, understand the complaint. I mean, that's the whole basis for justifying the fact that, you know, we can accuse people and feel justified that they know what they have to do in order to defend themselves.
Yes, and that's and when you
so what the term "or" to you think the lay person, what would that signify to the person?
That to me, to a lay person, that would signify that the prosecutor is just may or may not have evidence.
Does that tell him which one of the charge conduct he will have to face at trial?
No, it does not tell him specifically which.
Oh, specifically or generally, does it tell him which one of two or three? Or we're talking harassment here, six, I'm not sure how many, four or five pieces of conduct he will or she will be charged with or have to defend against at trial?
And that's where the uncertainty is, I believe. It doesn't make out exactly which one he or she would be fall under in that sense. So there is uncertainty on the face of the complaint. I think, and that's why it makes it harder. It, like you said, as a person of common understanding, it makes it hard for them to meet what they would have to face in court specifically.
But is there, in fact, any evidence in the record here that there was any confusion? I mean.